there are some changes coming to the King County Sheriff's Office. King County voters are going to get a chance to give the county council more power over the sheriff's office in November. The council has approved a pair of ballot measures. One of them would make the sheriff an appointee, just like the position used to be. The other takes power away from the agency as a whole, and Chris Sullivan has been looking into this. Chris.
You know, Dave, as you know, King County has elected a sheriff since 1996. Before that, it was an appointed position. Voters will have the chance to change that in November. The council will ask voters if they believe the sheriff should be appointed. Now, this is not a knee-jerk reaction to the latest civil unrest in the county. This was the recommendation of a charter review board that it had already suggested after about 18 months of work.
This proposed charter amendment, which would change the selection method from the sheriff from an elected office to an appointed and confirmed office, is not about being upset with or against the police. I just think that debate is... it's unappealing and it's not accurate.
Councilmember Rod Dombowski is prime sponsor of this plan. He believes the office has become way too political.
This would enable a nationwide search to choose the very best top law enforcement officer. It could and may very well be someone within the department, but it may be someone who doesn't want to be a politician.
Dombowski also believes that Seattle plays way too big of a role in electing the sheriff, and the politics of Seattle voters, who really aren't served by the sheriff's office, has way too much power in the decision-making process.
Those of us who represent cities with the sheriff's office, the cities themselves, and rural unincorporated and urban unincorporated residents, I think could and should play a stronger role in determining the sheriff.
The second major change that will go to voters in November could strip the sheriff's office of many of its duties. It kind of looks like a run at defunding the sheriff's office without actually calling that. It would allow the county council to actually decide what the sheriff's office can or cannot do. That's currently decided at the state level. This would give the council the power to decide what force deputies can use, how they make arrests, how they serve warrants, or perform other of their daily duties.
Well, I mean, that's the way the Seattle Police Department works. Chief is appointed by the mayor, and the city council sets the budget. And you remember too, right? When the sheriff was in appointed position, actually, it was when Dave Reichert was sheriff that it first switched to an elected position. I remember him saying, I don't know if I like the idea of being a politician.
Yeah, it's
but
an
he
interesting
became one.
And I think it's also very interesting, kind of the Dombowski's kind of side swipe at Seattle having way too much power in this when you consider that the city is served not by King County primarily. It's, you know, Kenmore and
Salt
Lake Terrace, you know, well, that's actually in Snohomish County. But, you know, other places around don't actually have as much voice in who their sheriff is because the Seattle voters vote their way and they just get who they decide.
Yeah, good point. Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. A neighborhood in downtown Vancouver, B.C. was wiped off the map more than 50 years ago for a freeway project, and a group there is working to keep its legacy alive. Our resident historian Felix Bunnell says part of that legacy has a deep connection to Seattle. Felix is brought to us by the King County Library System. Good morning, Felix.
Morning, Dave. I've often wondered about comparisons between Seattle and Vancouver, B.C. in all sorts of categories. And for the past few years, I've been hearing quite a bit about what was the black neighborhood in Vancouver. It was a place called Hogan's Alley. It's the Strathcona section of the city, not far from the train station. How it was wiped out when the Georgia Street viaducts were built in the early 70s. Those viaducts, which were part of a freeway that was never completed, are now slated to be torn down. So there's been a lot of community interest about what will go in their place, and there were Black Lives Matter demonstrators actually blocking traffic on those viaducts in June. Now, Stephanie Allen is a member of the Hogan's Alley Society. She told me Vancouver's black community grew in Hogan's Alley because it was near the railroad, and working for the railroad was one of the only well-paying jobs available. Redlining and restrictive covenants in other parts of the city came later for Vancouver as it did for Seattle. Now, that viaduct project back then wiped out the buildings and really the heart of what had been the black community, and the history of Hogan's Alley pretty much disappeared. Stephanie Allen says the black community in Vancouver has always been smaller than Seattle's, is never really more than about 1% of the population, and part of the reason was a Canadian law that was passed more than 100 years ago.
Unfortunately, in 1911, our then prime minister, who was Wilfrid Laurier, his cabinet passed an order to ban black migrants from coming to Canada. And while it was overturned not long after, there was a very institutionalized immigration policy in Canada that kept Black migration from coming here. It was very intentional. So I think what happened too is that that stunted the growth of the community as well.
So though the community was small, there's at least one deep connection between Hogan's Alley and Seattle, and that's the family of Jimi Hendrix. His father, Al, was born in Vancouver and came to Seattle in 1940 to find work, and that's where he met Jimi's mom. But it turns out that Al's mom, Jimi's grandma, Nora Hendrix, was a community leader in Vancouver in her own right. She was born in Tennessee in 1883 and arrived in Vancouver in 1911, before that law was passed, after spending time in Chicago and Seattle. Nora Hendrix is featured in a 1977 oral history collection describing life in Hogan's Alley. She worked at several of the iconic restaurants in the neighborhood, most of which were owned and operated by women. And she's considered a founder of the AME Fountain Chapel Church, one of the first Black churches in Vancouver and an important gathering place. Nora Hendrix was on the board of directors. She helped recruit preachers and was a lifelong member of the choir. Stephanie Allen of the Hogan's Alley Society says that Nora Hendrix was such a pillar of the community, they named a 52-unit supported housing complex after her.
It's been a real heartwarming story that even though she had this really famous grandson who did come here and spend some summers with his grandmother, she really is our hero here in Vancouver because of what a significant member and contributor to the community that she was.
And that famous grandson, Jimi Hendrix, of course, made his mark on Seattle and the rest of the world. Seattle-based Hendrix biographer and historian Charles R. Cross told me that Jimi did have a special connection to Vancouver, B.C., and a lot of that was because of Nora Hendrix.
He ended up going to Vancouver and staying with his grandmother. And that says a lot about the adult Jimi Hendrix, that he would pick his grandmother over his dad. So this was 1962, and Jimi took up and ended up in a band in Vancouver for a while called Bobby Taylor and the Vancouvers. Talk about a hometown-sounding name. Jimi was the rhythm guitar player, so he wasn't the lead guitar player of that band. The lead guitar player, Jeopardy question one day, maybe, was Tommy Chong of the later stoner duo Cheech and Chong.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy? Yeah. And Nora Hendrix called her grandson Jimi by the nickname of Buster, by the way, which I love. Charles R. Cross says it was a car trip by Jimi and his family from Seattle to Vancouver in 1968, when Jimi was at the height of his fame, that led to a troubling episode in Skagit County.
He stops with the family in Mount Vernon, of all places, at essentially a Denny's, and they're going to eat lunch, and they were not served. I mean, it almost makes me want to cry, frankly, to tell you that story. Because Seattle presents itself in many ways as if it's a more progressive place. But the idea that at that point, in 1968, that any restaurant in Washington State would not serve a family because they were Black just makes me sick to my stomach to even tell that history. But that is part of the history.
Yeah, and Charles says that eventually a kid asked Jimi for an autograph and finally the staff grudgingly gave the Hendrix family menus. Now, back in Vancouver, Stephanie Allen and her group wanted to get more units of affordable housing built where Hogan's Alley once stood. They wanted to do things to sort of restore that cultural legacy that was all but wiped off the map in that lost neighborhood. They've gotten a really positive response from the Canadian government, the federal government so far, but the city of Vancouver has not been as forthcoming.
They haven't shared any updates with us lately, so we're not clear when the actual highway structures will eventually fall. We're just hopeful that they would work with us and negotiate through all the preambling, you know, parts of this and setting the terms and conditions so that when those highway structures do fall and when this redevelopment can take place, that we're well positioned to move it forward.
This is actually part of the history we don't get taught in school, Felix, isn't it? Because from what we're seeing now, there were federal documents which actually conditioned some of the highway funds on deliberately building those freeways to separate racial communities.
Oh, yeah, and it's always easiest to wipe out the neighborhoods that have the quietest voice or have no voice whatsoever. And if you're being redlined, if you're not even can't get jobs outside, like being, you know, working for the railroad or working as a shoe shine or whatever, of course, that's going to be the neighborhoods they target. That's where all that urban renewal happened, you know, 50 years ago. And that's why we're seeing this response in Vancouver to take back the history that was wiped away and restore the history, but also put in stuff like affordable housing, which brilliant combination for this Hogan's Alley Society up in Vancouver.
Yeah, I'm surprised it did it in Canada as well as here.
I know. I always think Canada's this utopian thing north of the border. And then when they do stuff like this, I think, oh, no, come on, it's Canada.
Yeah. Felix Spinell, you can hear all his features at MyNorthwest.com. Thanks, Felix.
Thanks, Dave.
It was the decision everyone knew was coming but hoped would not. Most high school sports are off for the fall. That includes football, soccer, and volleyball. Here's Chris Sullivan.
Friday night lights are going to be dark this fall. Football and most other fall sports are the latest casualties of the pandemic. The Washington Interscholastic Activities Association really had no choice, considering the current state of the coronavirus. Under the governor's phase reopening plan, let's not forget football wasn't even going to be allowed until phase four. That's simply not happening by next month. WIAA board president Greg Whitmore.
I don't think there was anyone in the boardroom that felt we could get the high-risk sport of football played this fall. Doesn't look like the state of COVID and everything else was going to allow us to do that.
Football, volleyball, girls soccer, and small boys soccer will now be pushed to early spring. The school year will now have four athletic seasons instead of three, with football and the others squeezed between basketball season and in before baseball season. Now, the low-risk, low-contact sports of cross-country, swimming, golf, and tennis, for those who normally play those sports in the fall, are still scheduled. But Whitmore says they're at risk, too.
We've kept some low-risk sports as options, and we know those are in great peril, too. A lot of things have to happen in our favor in order for those to happen.
And while the sports are still alive on paper, WIAA Executive Director Mick Hoffman says there is no guarantee that your child will have an opportunity to play.
Because this is happening so incredibly fast, we want to make sure we're giving information for schools to plan. But also make sure everybody understands that when you look at dates, those are definitely written in pencil.
Hoffman also made it clear that the WIAA is working within strict guidelines here, set both at the national and the state level on when it's safe to play.
So I get the question several times a day, who determines these things? The medical people determine it. It's not Greg Whitmore, Mick Hoffman, or Casey Johnson sitting around an office doing these things. It's the medical professionals and the scientists who are doing that.
There's also a concern that if the sports are given the okay to play, there won't be enough officials. The lack of officials has already been well documented in our state, but a recent survey showed 30% of them weren't even comfortable calling games right now with the coronavirus out there. There's also a concern that many of the state's top football players will go to other states to play football in the fall, like Idaho, which has no restrictions right now. The WIAA has no plans on how to handle that if and when they decide to come back and play football in Washington as well in the spring. So there's a lot going on here with what's going to happen with the kids, with the play, what's going to happen. Are some kids going to go to other states and whatnot?
Yeah.
It's just a very difficult situation.
What's different in Idaho?
Well, they said they can go ahead.
Well, I mean, have they found some magical way to make it safer?
No, they've just decided they're going to play. Because their cases are lower than Washington's.
It's Idaho.
And then there are many other states that are doing the same thing. That are still going forward with football. And so that's just the way it is.
Idaho has a very independent spirit, I'll tell you that much. Living near it for so many years over in Spokane, they do things differently.
I understand that, but I mean, you can have all the independence you want, but if after the first practice everyone's sick, you're not going to have a season, right?
It doesn't appear that's driving the decision, though.
No.
That's what I'm saying.
Exactly. So, you know, Washington's made their decision. I know there were so many people on my social yesterday reaching out to me. I mean, I'm really entrenched in high school sports.
Yeah.
I'm wearing my Tommy's High School, you know, a shirt today. They're like, what are we going to do? I was talking to coaches and kids like, man, I can't believe we're going to potentially lose two. I talked to a friend who's got a kid who really wants to play baseball in college. You know, he lost his junior year and he could potentially lose his senior year as well. I mean, it's just it's unreal what's happening out there. But
yeah. And it's tough if not everybody's in the same boat. So are there other states that are going to have an advantage then because of this?
Oh, yeah, completely. Yeah. Plus, a lot of kids who are looking at potentially playing at the next level will be able to have film where the kids in Washington may not, to send to coaches and whatnot. So that's going to be a great disadvantage in why you might see some kids going to other states to be able to get some film that they can send on then to colleges.
Yeah. Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. We're all looking for a way to try to get schools open safely. And Seattle Port Commissioner Ryan Calkins had an idea. Why not hold class outdoors at one of the Port of Seattle's many parks? So, Ryan, tell us about your offer.
Yeah, thanks, Dave, for having me on. I have got two kids in Seattle Public Schools. And, of course, from a personal perspective, we've been thinking a lot about how we can continue our kids' education, but do it in a way that's safe. And as a Port of Seattle commissioner, we've got 60 acres of green spaces around the city that I think would be excellent places for kids to do outdoor education. And when I saw recently that one of the Seattle school board members had posted the idea of exploring outdoor education, I thought, why not chime in and let them know we would love to work with them on that kind of opportunity? So our parks run up and down the Duwamish River, along Elliott Bay, basically throughout areas of the city where there are really lots of residences, lots of students. And as an ulterior motive, we'd love to have kids get exposure to the things that we do at the Port of Seattle, the maritime and environmental jobs of the future that, that could be a part of their education as well.
Okay, so how would that work? Would you set up a tent and desks? Are there enough restrooms? How would it work?
Well, we haven't yet started the conversation with Seattle Public Schools, and really they're the experts on the education component. We've got locations, and in fact, we have been working on a couple of different workforce education youth initiatives in which we have a robust internship program that involves about 100 high school kids each year. So we do have some experience in what it's like to bring kids onto our property, give them a good education. So I think the possibilities are pretty wide open. And in a time of pandemic, if there are any silver linings, one of them is certainly the opportunity to look at innovative ways to approach old problems. And we know that kids do really well in outdoor settings. And we also know that while there are certainly benefits to virtual learning, in-person learning satisfies so many of the needs for our kids, the needs for social interaction, the needs to engage with their professional teachers. You know, that's one lesson I've learned in the months since March when Seattle Public Schools closed up physical locations is that, you know, we do our best as parents, but we're not professional educators. And so the opportunity to get kids in front of their teachers again in person would be great. And so if this works, if we can find a way to support outdoor education for local schools, we'd love to do it.
Yeah. Well, you're not going to get any pushback from me on the value of in-person education. I mean, obviously there's no substitute for it. It just seems like you've got some logistical problems there because some of the parks are in sort of remote areas. You'd have to bus kids in. You'd have to have some sort of shelter, I would think. And, of course, the whole restroom issue. Has anybody stepped up and said, yeah, this is a good idea. Let's work out details?
I did actually hear back from the school board member who initially posted it, and she said, stay tuned. So I'm looking forward to some engagement on that. The good news is many of our existing parks already have restroom facilities, have already hosted camps and other outdoor education opportunities. So we're not starting from square one. We do have some facilities. And the way I think about it, Dave, is it's not necessarily that we need to totally replicate all the services that would be available in a standard school, but working together to come up with innovative ways to provide in-person education in a safe manner means doing some outside-the-box thinking, figuring out who's got the resources and capabilities to do it. I think a lot of our locations would serve as great outdoor educational opportunities, and so I'm looking forward to the conversation with other elected leaders to determine, is there a way to do this?
Well, give us an example of the kind of facilities you have. I mean, if you had your choice, what would be your favorite location for an outdoor classroom?
A few of the kind of hidden gems that the Port of Seattle manages around Seattle include Centennial Park, which is right along the Elliott Bay waterfront, north of Myrtle Edwards Park. So they're conjoined parks that when you're in them, you hardly notice the difference. But that park includes lots of open space, lots of beachfront areas, their restroom facilities, and there are areas where students can congregate safely in groups and still be able to social distance. And it would be close to neighborhoods such as Magnolia and Queen Anne and downtown, where there are significant populations of students. So that might be a good spot. In South Seattle, along the Duwamish, we have a number of parks as well. There are parks that run along West Marginal Way that already have parking and restrooms. And then over against West Seattle, we have Jack Block Park, which is a park right at the sort of southwestern corner of Elliott Bay.
Yes, I've been there.
Yeah, it's a beautiful location, easily accessible to folks in West Seattle, too, without having to cross over the Duwamish and the ill-fated West Seattle Bridge.
Exactly. Well, if summer holds up, and it's been a pretty good summer so far, I don't think you'll get any quarrel from the kids on going outside. So keep us up to date. I mean, whatever works, right?
Will do, will do. And, you know, I think another good example of a program like this that has been working already is the early childhood education program called Tiny Trees, which has been running toddler and pre-K education in Seattle for over a decade now. So we know that we've got some expertise in-house here that we could lean on to get some advice on how to educate kids in outdoor settings. And so I hope the Port of Seattle can chip in and do our part to make doing a pandemic.
Seattle Port Commissioner Ryan Calkins. Ryan, thanks very much.
Thank you, Dave.
It's time for your daily dose of kindness now, sponsored by Mike Novak and listwithnovak.com. A group of young boys in Morristown, New Jersey, doing some good after witnessing so much bad.
This year, the main reason we saw we wanted to help out the community is because of the coronavirus and all that. You turn on the news and you see all this negative stuff on the news, and we were we want to do something positive. And so we decided to go local.
And WABC there decided to put some rock and roll music,
yes, they did,
in their interview. Yeah. The boys are 14 years old. They started a lawn care business called Leaf It To Us. Get it? And they donate 10% of their proceeds to charity. They've donated to St. Jude's Children's Hospital and will soon donate to their local food bank, making their parents proud, of course.
Seeing kids going out in the morning, working hard to raise funds, and actually giving it back to a community, to me, that was the most touching thing that we could have had. These kids not only have the effort and the ethic to go out and work, but they also have a gift, and that's the gift of giving. You know, give. Not everybody has that.
They do a couple jobs a day, working from 9 a.m. until often around dinner time, using their motorbikes to haul equipment to job sites.
I love that I can give back to what I have to the community, doing a small part.
Just to see how the Bedoyas help out this community, it's awesome to be a part of what they're doing.
I feel I'm helping people and making other people feel happy and not just myself.
The teens now getting calls from all over the county where they live, requiring their parents to drive them around to the closest job site requests. They say they'll keep running Leaf It To Us as long as their mission remains the same, helping others in need.
And spreading loud rock music.
Yeah, that was ABC News.
Oh, was it
for
not?
That. Yeah, I know. It's always a bummer when TV stations do that. And I try to...
I know. If I had a choice between, hearing a leaf blower and loud rock music, I might choose the rock music.
Yeah, you're right. By the way, should there be, what time is the official, unofficial cutoff time for yard work in neighborhoods? Because I've got a neighbor who's still mowing their lawn around 9:30 at night.
That's too late to mow.
That's got 8:30.
Of course, they're probably waiting until it's cooler.
I just want to know what everybody's opinion is. I mean, should I say something? 989-973, let me know what you think. What's the official cutoff time for yard work in neighborhoods, suburban neighborhoods?
You know my strategy. I wait for the other guy to mow the lawn first, and then I start up my lawnmower. So nobody can blame me for
starting. That's how you can avoid confrontation. I'm just curious if I'm out of line here.
Yeah. Here is G. Scott, and Dre's will be filling in for Ursula again today. So it's official. The King County executive, Dow Constantine, says that by 2025, they will no longer be locking up kids at the juvenile detention center. So is that enough, you think, to make people who've been trying to get it closed happy?
There, Dave, right now, there is a lot of, I don't even want to call it leadership. There's just a lot of things being thrown out there to gain support or to pull on the heartstrings and emotions of others. Let me tell you something, Dave. This ain't going to happen. What do you mean, 2025? Look, is there a good idea to move towards that way in the future? Absolutely. I would love for a young 16-year-old to be able to go and see a mental health evaluator every single time. But you see, guys, this society that we have created and built, it is way too late for this to be done by 2025. Do I think there's a possibility of maybe this happening maybe in 50 years, in 75 years? Yeah, I don't think it's going to happen in this generation. You have this generation, and like my mom and grandma, and they used to say, child, Y'all kids today, y'all something else. And I used to always get mad when they would talk that way. And then now here I am, an adult right now. And I'm saying some of the same things because kids today, the children today, do not have the respect of yesterday. And
so, just to be clear, so you're saying that there are still kids who need to be locked up?
Yes, okay. Absolutely. Yes. There's emotion coming from me, guys, right now on this topic, and I'll tell you why here in a second. Yes. Because there are some kids that as soon as they are born into generations, like for an example, guys, the same way you talk about generational wealth, the same way that some children are born with the, quote, silver spoon in their mouth, there are some kids in some situations that are born into a certain type of lifestyle, and sometimes it's no turning back. Now, I'm not saying that we should not be putting more resources. I'm not saying that we should just make that the goal. I am saying, everybody, it is unrealistic to think that by 2025 that we're going to be ridden all juvenile homes or detention centers by then. That is unrealistic, and I will say it to Dow Constantine's face or anybody else that thinks so, because this is what...
What makes it unrealistic?
It is... Because there are so many problems that are tied to this. You can't all of a sudden have all of these issues that we've had for so many years, systemic racism, redlining, and all of these different things that we've had where we have taken fathers out of the homes with war on drugs, and then just to expect that, oh, hey, by the way, community, by 2025, yeah, we're going to be done with all of that. Guys, that's in 5 years. Do people really think the problem is going to be fixed in that long? No. We have kids that are killing people on the streets right now. You can't fix it overnight. And so the frustration that I have and what you guys hear from me is that we are getting leadership now that is playing to the heartstrings and emotions of others. That includes the whole 50% defunding of the police. That wasn't thought out. Who in the world thought it was a good idea to go ahead and cut 50% budget from a Seattle Police Department? That was not a good idea. And you want to know who suffers in that situation? Poor neighborhoods first. That's who suffers from those type of things. Not the rich neighborhoods. They don't. But what's starting to happen is, again, we're having leadership that is just saying, hey, you know what? Maybe they'll like this. Or maybe this is cool. Maybe
that's what the poor neighborhoods want, because there have been protests. I mean, I remember coming upon one of the protests outside the juvenile center when they were just finishing up, and I asked him, you know, so I understand what you guys want, but, you know, tonight there's going to be some kid out of control who, if you leave him alone, is going to, you know, shoot up a school or something. You mean to say we shouldn't lock him up? And they said, that's right. That's exactly right. So, I mean, what does the neighborhood want?
The neighborhood wants what every neighborhood wants. Every neighborhood, whether you're poor, rich, black, white, everybody wants to live. Everybody wants to eat. Everybody wants their kids to live. My buddy of mine, last night on Cherry, young man who used to come spend a night in my house, lost his life last night, 19 years old. So if these leaders, I hope some of these leaders are listening right now. If you think things are going to be just fixed by saying, oh, what about this idea? Would you guys like this? No, everybody, you know, this tweet on Twitter, this whole, quote, law and order. People act like regular citizens don't want, everybody wants law and order. Nobody wants that. We just don't want it disguised in bad ways and for bad things to happen. But all of us, we want law and order. So back to the whole conversation, Dave, in regards to can this happen by 2025? Listen, no, it can't happen by 2025.
So you knew the victim, what you're telling me.
Last night, yes. Yes. I had to have a conversation. I texted with my son about it. My son showing me the direct messages from him and him and this young man telling my son how proud he is of my son. I'm heartbroken today. Not because, I mean, it hasn't happened in the past. I'm heartbroken because people just, there's some of these leaders just think that this is a quick fix. And they're just not thought out.
I'm guessing that's going to come up on your show today.
Yeah, it will.
Yeah. G. Scott's going to be joined by Drake this morning starting at 9 here on Cairo Radio. Dre's, I'm sorry.
All right.
Going to be joined by Dre's starting at 9 on Cairo Radio. Thank you, G. Let's go live to Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott now. The man accused of driving into a crowd of protesters on I-5, killing one, severely injuring another, is due in court in about an hour. So where are you this morning, Hannah?
Dave, I'm at City Hall Park right next to the King County Courthouse. This is where probably 30 to 40 people have gathered right now. They're just setting up. There's a rally set for between 8 and 10 a.m. here this morning in support of Dia's Love. She's the 32-year-old. They're the 32-year-old who was hit by this gentleman's vehicle who's accused of hitting her, along with Summer Taylor, who passed away after that incident on I-5 back early on July 4th. They're here. They want to set up and kind of do a rally of support, a vigil sort of for Summer, and also show support for Diaz, who is, I'm told, going to join from her hospital room via Skype and speak on a screen that they're going to set up here in just a short while. And there's just people here. There's young people. Some of these folks I recognize from being up at the Chaz Chop area previously. The trumpet player who's been known to be around all of these protests is here. And they're flowers. People are just bringing flowers. Very peaceful, very mellow, not like any kind of raging protest. Just a vigil to show support and demand justice. And they, the organizer I talked to here said they believe that this driver did this intentionally. They were there. They were out on I-5 the night that this incident happened. And they believe it was intentional.
They think it was intentional. Now, the investigation seems to indicate no. The problem was that he was in some way inebriated, right?
Yeah, and I don't see it really laid out in the court documents just yet. All I see that there's nothing mentioned of any intentionality. And really, the charges are vehicular assault, vehicular homicide, reckless driving. And there's a lot of discussion about possible drugs and drug paraphernalia that were found in the driver's vehicle, and also that he may have been withdrawing from Percocet, had some sort of addiction issue. But I've not seen that direct, connecting of the dots as to whether that was to blame or whether something else was going on here. Hopefully at this arraignment we'll learn more.
Why? No, so have you talked to any of the protesters about why they think it was intentional?
They think it was intentional because they were on I-5 when that happened and saw what to them could be nothing less than deliberate. They said he had his hazards on when he drove on, as if to suggest he was maybe one of them trying to, because remember, some of the demonstrators had vehicles themselves that were blocking off certain ramps. So that's the way the organizer I was just talking to said she thought that perhaps he was trying to make it seem like he was one of them just trying to park his vehicle, and that it was a deliberate hard turn, and that he drove right into the crowd, and that it could be nothing else. So we'll have to see if there's evidence of that as far as the prosecutors go. Again, not seeing anything specific yet.
Okay, but I mean, as has been pointed out to me by a number of listeners, some of them repeatedly, the guy was black, and this is a Black Lives Matter protest. So what would the deliberate motive be?
Anybody's guess. I haven't heard. The organizer I just talked to didn't know, and we've not seen anything as far as motive laid out in any of the court documents or any of the investigators that I've talked to either. So would have to be seen. I know in the interview that he did with investigators right after his arrest, I didn't see anything to suggest that. In fact, if you recall, he almost immediately asked if the people who he hit were okay.
Right. All right. Hannah Scott outside the courthouse. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.